On this week's episode of The Apex, we are joined by the legendary Tiff Nadell. Tiff has competed at Le Mans 14 times, climbed the single-seater ladder all the way to F1, and competed in touring cars, British Rallycross, and the 24 Hours of Daytona. He also commentated alongside Murray Walker and entertained the nation with his work on Top Gear and Fifth Gear. He joins us today to talk about his life in cars, the ins and outs of competing at events like Le Mans, and what it was like to race in such an incredible era of motorsport. Tiff, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that wonderful build-up. There's too much to talk about. That's always the trouble, all those different titles I've done. But you
almost don't need an intro either, Tiff. Everyone knows who you are. One thing that I did notice when I was doing my sort of research was that you grew up very near Goodwood, and you were able to watch Mike Hawthorne, Stirling Moss, Jim Clark all race.
Yes, well, I was born in Havant, very near Goodwood, but that was only because my mother's mother lived there. In the old days, the dad never came to the birth or anything like that. So the mothers would very often go to their mothers, to be looked after. So yeah, I was dragged straight back to Weybridge, and where my dad had rented a flat. And we lived in the same flat for 20 years. My dad was really good at making money living in Weybridge, sorry. Everybody thinks I'm yet another kid with a silver spoon when you say I lived in Weybridge. Oh, yeah, rich dad. In fact, Dad rented a flat in Weybridge. So he could have bought an acre for £2.50 and it would be worth £2.5 million, but he didn't. Because Dad had lived in Weybridge, and he went to watch the aero engine machine at Goodwood. So the Nadell passion for speed began really at Brooklands when Dad went there before the war. Actually, he did an auto test at Brooklands. So he actually competed at Brooklands, maybe not on the banking, but... of course, after the war, when Brooklands was closed, then Goodwood opened, and Dad did two of the first members' meetings. Three-lap handicap races. He had an old V8 Ford, battered old thing, and put the windscreen flat and no crash helmet. Put his aviator shades on to look cool and did three-lap handicaps. And then, of course, since he had a family, mum banned him from racing, not that he really had any money to. And he would take us as soon as I could walk, and we were dragged to Goodwood and started spectating in the mid-50s and just kept, as you said, watched Stirling Moss and Mike Hawthorne. And then, of course, Jim Clark came along and he became my huge hero. And the passion began at Goodwood, very much so.
And I imagine the impression that watching those races had on you, sort of in terms of seeing them race and then being like, that's what I want to go and do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I crawled up the banking. That's why I love going back to Goodwood. I was in floods of tears. I mean, my Goodwood revival TV bit I did for Top Gear, and you see it on YouTube now, I was genuine tears because, Lord March had recreated my dream. I actually tested there. We did a lot of testing in Formula 3 in the 79, so I hadn't driven the track. But when I walked into that circuit, it was the same as when I walked in as a five-year-old. And the banking on the exit of the chicane is the first banking I clambered up as a five-year-old and peered over the top and saw these loud, noisy, smelly machines being wrestled through the chicane. And that was it. Just wanted to be a racing driver. That was it. Never going to be because there was no money in the family. So never going to happen.
And then the opportunity to actually go racing didn't come until you sort of won a Formula Ford in a magazine competition.
I still can't believe it happened. I mean, it is just so bizarre. I mean, it's a Hollywood story, because when I left school in the summer of 69 and I raided my post office account for all the money I'd earned cutting grass and cleaning cars of the neighbours and borrowed Mum's Morris Sales and went out to Brands Hatch, the racing school. So I spent a couple of years there just handing over my money to Tony Lanfranchi to do five more laps in a single seat for £5. Well, they did have races. I did a couple of school races in 1970. So I had sort of raced, but I just thought that, maybe if I met a millionaire or preferably a millionaireess, in Weybridge, that they would sponsor me because they saw the effort I was making. But eventually, instead of a millionaireess, it was the Autosport magazine competition that made it all happen by winning that Formula Ford Lotus 69S.
And it was a competition you actually had to put a fair amount of effort into as well.
It wasn't one of these easy things. They were very popular in the 70s, late 60s. You had to, whatever the product was, they would create 10 things about that product and you had to put them in order of importance. And the Lotus competition was 10 cars for preparation for a motor race. You had to put the most important things. Then, as with all the other things, washing up powder had the most important thing. It had to run your washing machine. And then experts would decide the correct 10 in their right order. And you'd buy an extra line. It used to be a shilling a line. I think it was 2 shillings. I can't remember. So I bought about 20 lines, which is a lot of money back then because I didn't earn anything. And one of my lines was closest to the what the judges thought, and I won the car. Not that I knew anything about preparing a car for a race, mind you.
Well, you say that, but you did. You know, you came from a civil engineering background as well. Did that help the mechanical side of things?
No, I don't think so. No, I was never. My motorbikes, they used to fall apart regularly. I used to fall off them regularly in both when I was 16. I was terrible. I did things by trial and error. It's quite funny, actually. When I won the Lotus, you know, because there was no money with it. It was a brand new trailer, a course at the Jim Russell Racing School, but no sponsorship. I owned a rusty Morris 1000 Traveller by then, and I had to scrape the rust off the back. I bought a Twitter. I think it's a Twitter, not Twitter. It can't be Twitter. A Witter tow bar. And bolted it on and then sort of got the trailer on the back. And when I first changed the gear ratios, I thought, well, I'm going to change the gear ratio. Not that it had any spare gear ratio. I had to buy one more top gear. And I had a friend with a pen and paper. As I pulled the back off the gearbox, he sort of wrote down the order the bits fell out. And I just about put it back in the same order. And then mechanical knowledge was something I learned that I had to learn fast because, you know, I couldn't afford a mechanic or a preparation company. I was now, you know, a civil engineer 5 days a week, a mechanic in my little rented lock-up 5 nights a week. And then at the weekend, I was the van driver, the mechanic and the racing driver. And so started my long climb up the ladder. But it was wonderful, wonderful times.
I think you also got some mechanical experience fixing your mother's car at some point, didn't you?
Well, yeah, well, that was the Morris 1000. I used to practice sliding around roundabouts and once fell off the road in Burwood Park and went over the top of some rocks. And that was a long story. I don't know. Have I written that story in the book? I don't know. But
you did, yeah. I think she was a bit surprised.
Punched a hole. Yeah, when she found the rear carpet was glued down because I drove it to... I was at school and there was a sixth form. There was a school workshop and I went back at the weekend and we welded up the floor with a bit of paddling and glued the rear carpet down. It had landed on top of this flipping rock, punched a hole in the floor. So, when she couldn't unglue the carpet, she sussed the problem.
And then all that hard work paid off because you did eventually work your way all the way up the single-seater ladder and made it to F1. When you were on the grid for that sort of first F1 race with Ensign, was that like the ultimate realization?
Yeah, that was just incredible. I do have to actually today, in fact, put a couple of links in there because, of course, it was a Unipart Formula 3 team. I was voted the most promising young driver like the Autosport Awards today when it's the Grosvenor Awards. That got me the professional drive in 77 with Unipart. But then in 79, I got this lift up to the British Formula One Championship with the Durex Scholarship. And this car was prepared by Graham Eden, who sadly passed away just last month. I only learned of it just yesterday. So one of those incredibly lucky links, you know, I won the Autosport magazine, then I got the Grover Award and I got the Unipart Formula 3 drive. And then this Durex Formula One car, that Aurora British Championship, which was, they were year-old Formula One car. The mine was 3 years old. So it got me driving a Formula One car. And on our debut in Zolder, I finished second place. And this was Graham Eden that had bought it and ran it. And he was the mechanic on his own. He rebuilt the DFP. He was a wonderful man, mechanic, racing driver, and sadly passed away last month. So anyway, then there we were. Yes, so having got that Graham Eden, all these people have to remember to help me so much. I got to the grid again. Cooled in at last minute. I had a half a day's testing at Donington, which didn't really relate to Zolder, before I went out to try to qualify. Because, of course, in those days, 30 cars used to turn up and only the fastest 24 got the grid. So I was petrified of not even qualifying, but managed to get through and ended up on the last row. They got qualified 23rd, which was the same place as Clay Regan's only qualified when, of course, he had the awful accident that gave me the opportunity. And of course, there was no second car, so nobody could compare my lap time. So I was very much on my own. I felt really chuffed at 23rd. And then when I sat on the grid, look beside me, Emerson Fittipaldi. Me? Emerson Fittipaldi, of course, is one of my schoolboy heroes and a Lotus. He was almost the sort of the new Jim Clark to me in many ways when he arrived at Lotus and did Formula Ford and Formula 3, and then he was promoted very quickly. So, I sat on the grid. I don't know. I actually started... singing or humming the Top Gear, not the Top Gear, the Grand Prix theme tunes. I'm fired up the car and I'm sitting revving, looking around me, and I was kind of going dum da da dum da. But I thought I was still watching it on telly, you know, because it happened so quick. So I mean, I was only substitute. They wanted Jan Lammers. Jan Lammers had been the superstar at Long Beach the race before. He qualified fourth, I think, and the Unipart Ensign had a new American investor and he was obsessed with Jan Lammers. And Jan wasn't free because he was standing in for Mark Seurat. Mark Seurat broke a leg. And you got so many opportunities in those days. Break a leg, you get a few Grand Prix. But I knew that once Mark Seurat was fit, Lammers was kicked out of ATS and he would be in, as it happened with the Ensign. But it destroyed his career, poor man, because the Ensign, as I tried to tell Mo Nunn, was a bit of a rubbish car at the back of the grid. But then Jan came in. He didn't even qualify for about six Grand Prix on the trot. Couldn't even make the 24. So it wasn't that good a car. But to me, it was the most magnificent, beautiful Grand Prix car that I still have photos of and look at. And yes, you know, I'd got to the top of Everest. And I was sort of saying, I mean, it's just ridiculous for me to be a racing driver. Now there's only 20. I mean, it's ridiculous. Mm. So there's only 20 in the whole world. And after dinner speeches, I said, you imagine every Premier League, just the Premier League football teams in Britain have a 34-man squad. And there's 20 of them. So that's 640, something like that. And that's just Britain, yeah. You know. So you imagine the talent, the mountain of talent that tries to become a Grand Prix driver. And of course, now this sort of horrible 10-flipping team clique isn't letting anyone else join. There's only ever going to be 20 drivers if they have their own way. And they don't get injured anymore as much. Sorry, touch wood. I mean, it shouldn't say that, but the opportunities don't come. So just getting to the top of Mount Everest. I didn't stay there for long as Jan was in. And once you reach the peak and you start sliding down the other side, you know it's over. And I was so lucky that, you know, Group C sports cars was growing and I started them, you know, 10 years in world sports cars. But then Grand Prix, being a Grand Prix driver, I've got the watch, not on. Grand Prix Drivers Club with my name on it. And that's my most cherished possession, is the fact that I did make it to that very exclusive club. Didn't stay there, but in fact, I picked up the stats of 1980. You know, talk about drivers getting a chance, which they don't get anymore. There were 41 drivers, including me, that tried to qualify or had the opportunity that year. So there was so much more chance of getting a race. And it's a shame now, is that these kids, they're all giving up at 20, aren't they? 21. Mm-hmm. I'm too old. I'll go and be a GT racing driver. I'm never going to be a Grand Prix driver. I'm too old.
Yeah, I mean, you did get to drive at Monaco, though. That must have been pretty special.
That was epic. Well, I was just, I looked through Stefan Johansson's interview. I was a good friend of Stefan. We raced Formula 3 together. And I just jumped out when he was talking about those 1,500 horsepower qualifying laps. And he had wheel spin all the way up the hill towards the square, and it was just crazy. But even with my mere little 550 horsepower, I still remember that climb the hill, you know, out of Sandoval at the bottom. And the fact that it weaves, as Stefan was taught, you could only ever see sort of 300 yards ahead, and it just kinks left and right. And of course, you come to this crest over the top where you have to brake, so just along the crest, preferably, but not over it. And so, yeah, many amazing memories. Just driving a Grand Prix car around Monte Carlo was very, very special.
Did you ever get the chance to speak to Carlos Reutemann for holding you up?
No, I wish I had. Yeah, Mr. Reutemann. Oh. And the fuss they get for David, which is quite right, you know, people are holding anyone up at all nowadays in free practice, 1, 2, 3. But yes, I'm on my one lap with my new tyres. I had to switch to a spare chassis as well. And actually qualified, it's the most annoying thing. I was 19th in the wet session on the Thursday, so I was on the grid. And only 20 cars got on the grid in Monaco, and the 30 starters. And yeah, my first flying lap, I caught Reutemann wandering around the swimming pool area. And he just blocked me, just deliberately, because he didn't want some rabbits getting in his way. And then, of course, he started a lap and disappeared out of sight. You know, so I thought, that's good, I'm on a clear lap now. This could be, I could qualify. Came around the swimming pool, and there he was again. And apparently he was famous. If he had a bad lap, he'd abort it completely. And he just weaved again and just stopped me getting by again. And the third time I came around, I think he wasn't there. So I crashed because I couldn't believe he wasn't there. But by then, the tyres had gone. They had the best lap. And Mr. Reutemann holding me up. I could have been a star. I could have got through. Could have made it. But actually, for the non-qualifying club that year, was quite classy because it was Keke Rosberg and John Watson didn't qualify. Oh, wow. So I was in good company. And in fact, that was the last Grand Prix. And I think the first one since about the early 1950s. And didn't have a British Grand Prix driver, British driver on the grid. Because myself and Watson were the only ones from Britain. So a good pub quiz. The last time there wasn't a British driver on a grid was the 1980 Belgian, not Monaco Grand Prix.
And then from Formula One, you also spent a lot of time in Japan as well, doing the sports car racing over there.
Yeah, Well, I did Formula 2 first. Yeah. That was the place for money, you know, when the career was going off. I mean, there weren't many. It was the beginning of the great Japanese invasion when I earned about £10,000 a year. And I think by the time Eddie Irvine had fleeced everyone, he was on about £350,000 a year. So, yeah, the Gaijin Racing Drivers Club, I was a founder member when we started that over. Jeff Lees, myself, and AL, which is a Swedish driver, were the only three when it all began in sort of 79.
That must have been quite an extraordinary experience going over there and racing, though. I mean, that...
That was something, yeah. Well, we were going cheap as tickets as possible, you know, because you've got your money. And we used to get Aeroflot via Moscow. And I remember going to Moscow in this miserable, awful place. You weren't allowed anywhere when you went to the transit lounge, and it was a broken down, disgusting place. But yeah, we went Aeroflot and then raced, you know, we stayed in Tokyo. But in those days, there were no street signs. It was so foreign. Back then, you know, there were no street. You had the maps for Tokyo you bought were building maps. So you'd literally drive around until you found something that you could see in a picture, and then you'd work out where to go. I got named Tiff the Map in Tokyo because I was the best at working out how on earth we could find anywhere.
You've also, well, so extraordinary. You competed at Le Mans 14 times as well. Yeah, what makes that such a special race for you?
Oh, I don't know, because I mean, it's history, you see, because I was a true fan, a real anoraker, you know, crazy. And it's where all my heroes raced. All those legendary tales came back. And when I was at school, I used to do the sweepstake for Le Mans. I used to go around getting 10 shillings out of everyone for the sweepstake for Le Mans. And it was just this historic race. And to go there and drive around the same racing line as Jim Clark and Mike Hawthorn and all that historic racing comes, that made it special for me. As a racetrack, it's long, got lots of different corners and great straight. And I was always quite good on the straights, one of my fortes. But it's a magnificent circuit, a drive around a 4-minute lap, huge history. And then this 24-hour race, which was just so special to survive and get to the end of and finish, let alone, you know, get on the podium and stuff. And you used to race, I raced with amateurs first off, a bit like nowadays, a lot of young drivers in GT racing, you have a rich owner. I had Ian Bracey, Lloyd's underwriter, with his Ibec open-top sports car, my first Le Mans. And then I had Steve O'Rourke with the Emca Aston Martin, where we led Le Mans in 1985, and his Emca, really beefy in the first stint. So he was the Pink Floyd manager that paid for that car. So, it was very much then gradually I got to get professional drives and Toyota factory driver in 87, 88, and then... Porsche in 89, and then finally a private. I was back in Japan then by 1990, racing the Alpha private in the Japanese Group C, a 962 Porsche. And that's the car that the owner took over to Le Mans, and we came third on the podium at Le Mans. The only privateer, all the others were factory cars. We were beaten by the two Silk Cup Jags. Derek Bell, who was racing with me in Japan, but couldn't join me at Le Mans because he was factory signed. He finished fourth, and then the factory Toyota and the factory Nissan would finish that in the top six. So, so it's hard to compare being on the grid at my Grand Prix debut or being on the podium at Le Mans. Which was the finest moment? I can never give the answer. I'm sorry. They were just both magnificent moments.
Yeah. No, that 1990 race must have been very special.
Yeah. We drove flat out. We single stinted, you know, because we didn't have any backup and masseurs or dietitians or fitness trainers. We just drove flat out myself, you know, Anthony Reid and David Sears. Again, I actually got the other two in when Derek couldn't do it. And the Japanese said, well, what other drivers can we have for Le Mans? I picked two drivers that would like me, you know, that had the talent I knew, but hadn't really had the opportunities to get the results. So I was then chuffed for myself and for them.
And what was the Porsche 962 like to drive?
It was a bit brutal. So being a single-seater driver, all the Group C cars were, you know, a bit hefty and not so agile. And when you've grown up always in single-seaters, you know, they're all a bit of a shock, sports cars. You can't see so well. You've got the A-pillar, and so visibility is not the same. You can't see your little wheels. But they were, as a Group C car, they were the best. They were hard, heavy steering and a very heavy gear change because they had synchro gearboxes in those Porsches, which helped them last so much longer. So it was quite a lethargy. You couldn't fix through the gears. It was quite a lethargy, but hefty change. So they were hard work physically. And of course, ground effect had started to come in. So we had a lot of downforce, a lot of grip, a lot of G-force. So brutally physical when before you got used to them or got fit enough. Yeah. But magnificently reliable and, you know, sure-footed. Well, I had crashed one. I drove a Kramer one in 85 when the bunny suspension broke on me, put me in the barriers at the Porsche curb, which wasn't so much fun. Then 89, the flipping thing caught fire. Why have I just said the reliable? Why did I just say? I think the factory cars were always very reliable. I had a Kramer once throw me in the wall when the suspension broke. And then the poor Richard Lloyd red car in 89, 22 hours into the race, really hot weekend. We battled from 15th to 4th in a not very quick car. When a fracture in a new fuel housing that the factory had given out to all the teams. There were about three or four big fires that year because this same cast fuel unit cracked open. So I had to abandon the flaming Porsche.
I think, was it 82 as well, that you had quite a big accident on the straight? Do you remember?
Oh, that was my second one. That was the Aston Martin Nimrod. Yeah, my first sort of professional Group C drive, that was. And the rear bodywork departed going down the Mulsanne straight at 200 miles an hour. Unfortunately, attached to that was the rear wing. It was a rear hinged tail. And so I lost the whole lot. So my 200 mile an hour racing car became a 200 mile an hour wheelbarrow. And turned sharp right and then sharp left and then in the barriers. And then, that was a sizable crash. But you remember these things with such, because everything, because you're so full of adrenaline and concentration in motorsport, when things go wrong, it's amazing. Things go into slow motion because your mind's there working at double speed to think, well, what am I going to hit next? And where do I, So it went on. And I remember going backwards. I mean, I missed the first hit to the barrier on the right, spun it round and congratulated myself on how brilliant I was as not hitting the wall. When I realized I was now going backwards down the wall, so I'm straight at about 180. Again, steering backwards isn't easy. And I hit the barrier the other side and the whole front of the car came up and I thought, oh, I'm in the trees, I'm dead. But luckily it crashed down again and started spinning back across the road. And I remember when it was rotating once with debris and smoke, I noticed the two gullwing doors had flown off in that first impact. And I remember saying to myself, that's good, Tiff. At least when it stops, I'll be able to get out. But so it is amazing. And then, of course, you jump out and brush yourself off. As everybody on television, when you see Derek Warwick at Monza, wasn't it? Running back to the pits to get in the spare car, or Martin Brundle in Australia. We don't get shocked because you're concentrating 100% and you've got adrenaline and you're fired up. You don't get shocked when you crash a racing car. It's something the public can't understand.
Yeah, and this was before the chicanes went in as well, wasn't it?
They came in 1990, which is part of the story of the Porsche, because we were racing at Fuji Speedway. When they said we had the chicanes, I'd worked out that each straight was now the same length as the Fuji straight. So I said that maybe it would be high downforce or low downforce, because the Porsche factory said you'll have low downforce, because every year they made a fortune selling the low downforce kits. But I thought, no, maybe still going to need a bit of grip, because now with the chicanes you can go quicker down the Porsche curves. So we had a wing made up and tested the idea of the low downforce and the high downforce, and decided it would be a high downforce track. So we came with our high wing, and lo and behold, that was the way to go.
One of the other things I really wanted to ask you was, I think it was Daytona 95. Paul Newman was in the race as well. And I think you had a tire blowout or something and gifted him like the podium. Did you get to speak to him after the race? Or
no, I didn't. I could have asked for some money, couldn't I? No, that was one of them. I mean, I've had so many what ifs. I mean, when you're driving not in the factory teams, you're always slightly struggling with money and finance and stuff. And I mean, I was in this wonderful Kramer C8 from, what's his name? Got a name. Austrian guy. Get there in the end. It was about 6 o'clock in the morning. I was doing this wonderful dawn stint. We'd had some troubles earlier on. We were in third place and I was going faster and faster. The lap times were coming down and all of a sudden heading into the tri-oval after the turn four speedway, I just heard this almighty clarita blang and the car turned sharp left. But unfortunately for him, or luckily for me, there was some big old GTP car right next to me, which I managed to hit, which bounced me a bit straight for a while before I ended up rotating into the concrete on the outside of the circuit, right with the start-finish line, and then rolled down, sat in that grass area in front of all the pits and the mechanics, realizing another dream was gone. But Paul Newman flipping well got my third place. You're right. You're right. I should have gone and spoken to him.
You should have done, yeah. But you did race in such an incredible era of motorsport. Yeah. There's so many incredible names. Like, are there any sort of competitors that really stand out to you that you really enjoyed racing against?
What's that racing? I mean, Villeneuve was in the Race of Champions. I must say, I admired him. But if I was out of that Durex Chevron because in 1979, the Race of Champions, they mixed the British or the Aurora Formula One cars with the Grand Prix cars. And I remember he overtook me and qualified. And it was between Hawthorne and Westfield. Was it Westfield and Hawthorne? I always get those two mixed up. And then he went straight down to Westfield ahead of him, let him by. And then he was sideways opposite, up two wheels over the curbs, grass, dirt, and he just shot off down Dingle Dell and never saw him again. He was such a wonderfully gifted driver.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't recall. I mean, I raced against Jackie Hicks and Derek Bell was my teammates, and sports car wise. Single seater wise, you know, I grew up with Stefan Johansson and ALs, who never made Formula One, who maybe should have done. Nelson Piquet, of course, was very much my year of the Formula Three. So I was a good friend of Nelson's. So that was merely my era. But it was only really myself and Jeff Leeds. There were very few of us in that era, in British motorsport that actually got through to Formula One. As I said, you know, Monaco, it was only me and Watson were the only two to qualify. So it's anyway, Jeff Lee's one of those underrated drivers I ever raced against. He was really strong and I battled him in Formula Ford and Formula Three and hated him all along. But we ended up as teammates in Japan and we're big mates now and really talented. So Jeff Lee's was not... Derek Daly, of course, I raced against a lot in Formula Three. Derek Warwick raced in, so they're supposed... But they were sort of a year younger than me. But Derek Warwick, a lovely man as well. Really good, a great driver.
Transitioning slightly, alongside your racing career, you also got involved with the BBC and did some commentating for the F2 and F3 races. What was that like? What was it like working with Murray Walker?
I was another pioneer then. Like, I was a pioneer for Japanese drivers. I was a pioneer for expert analysts. And there weren't many in those days. It was the beginning of that. Now they're everywhere, you know. And yeah, I think I was got dragged. I used to go, of course, to Formula 2 races with my helmet and overalls, trying to get a drive, you know, to pick up a run, spread my word around. And I got dragged in with Murray Walker and had two or three wonderful years with that wonderful man. I always say he's the nicest man I've ever met in motorsport. I think he's the nicest man I've ever met anywhere in the world. I mean, just charming, kind to everybody. So I was his sort of protege in a way. I thought in the end I might end up being the commentator, but he left and ITV took over and I was still being a racing driver. So I never chased that too much. But yeah, I had a great time with Murray in the commentary box.
And then that, I think, was that in turn kind of led to your involvement with Top Gear and Fifth Gear? Is that how that
Well, I think so. Yeah, I think so, because Chris Goffey broke his ankle ice skating when he was supposed to test a Formula First racing car for Top Gear. And so he couldn't drive. So they said, oh, flipping, now we've got to get someone this weekend to drive. And so they had my phone number. They'd heard me talking, so they knew what I sounded like. So someone must have said, let's get Tish in. And so I was summoned to do that only one test, one program, just drive for Chris Goffey. Didn't even show me my helmet off, but I talked while I was driving. They wanted me to do that bit, and I thought before I did it, I thought it looks a bit dull sometimes, just, you know, this Formula One drive looks a bit easy sometimes. So I deliberately, on that very first thing, chucked it sideways and looked like I was about to crash every corner. And the producers were so amazed I could do this that I got asked back to do more and more and more, and then the Top Gear career took off by complete accident. My little links were always pretty much by luck. I suppose the unibike drive was because I was the most promising young driver of 76. The autosport was a bit of luck. And the it came through in the end, luckily.
But, and talking of being a pioneer as well, that segment you shot with the McLaren F1 for Top Gear,
yeah.
I watched it the other day. That is absolutely fantastic, that segment.
It's still what everyone remembers before, you know, that the original Top Gear. I mean, Top Gear was sort of on its knees a bit in the beginning of the 1990s. I joined and did my car driving. Then they got Jeremy in a year later to do his band comedy that he loves. And then Quentin Wilson came along. Jeremy's mate talk a lot of rubbish about secondhand cars. And so it really took off the mid-90s. And as you said, I did that McLaren test, which everybody still remembers. I love doing. And I loved it as well because, you know, I was allowed to do the whole story from the beginning, the road car. Well, nowadays, towards the end of my fifth gear career, they all are direct, well, just go out, spin the wheels, get sideways in the middle of the story. And I said, no, I want to walk around the car, build it up, and then have the sideways bit at the end.
Yeah.
And they let me do that. It was Ken Pollock, the producer at the time, that really created the piece and guided me through it. And, you know, give a lot of thanks to him for helping that happen. So, and the other one is always think when I took Jeremy and Quentin for a ride in a Ford Puma. It's the other big YouTube one that everyone watches. But it was a lot of fun. Mid-90s, we had about 6 million viewers, you know, the same as now. And wow. we weren't celebrities in those days. It's funny how celebrities grow now, isn't it? You've only got to have about 1 million viewers and you're a celebrity and you're everywhere.
Yeah.
But of course, Jeremy left to do his to his own chat show, and Quentin left to sell cars on the internet or something, and it died a bit. And then we were taken off air in 2001 or 2002. That's why I then created Fifth Gear. I went off to the Fifth Gear producers and said, well, not a Fifth Gear, but Channel 5. And so I brought the whole Top Gear team to Channel 5. Now, of course, I'm on Love Cars because Channel Fifth Gear died a death. And so now I'm doing Love Cars with my good friend Paul Woodman. And we do a podcast every Monday night as well about motorsport. Over the last, you know, weekend, I look back at motorsport. So podcasts, YouTubes, whatever next.
I know. It's confusing.
I've got to do TikToks or something. I don't know what TikToks or Tic Tacs.
Stay away, Tiff. Don't go on TikTok. And obviously, so it kind of goes full circle, really, because, I mean, you talk about those early years at Goodwood, and then you've had the opportunity to race there at the Revival as well. Now, how special is that to you?
Every year, it's amazing, because Charles Martin, the Duke, moved him on. I've got to move him on to the Dukes. I mean, he just recreated. I always remember there was a Star Wars episode, I don't know why I saw it, where there was a holiday planet, where if you went to this holiday planet, they'd create your holiday in your dreams. So whatever you dreamt of, that would be your holiday. And so when, you know, Charles rebuilt Goodwood, it was just like my dream. I thought, well, this is ridiculous. I'm now going to be driving my dream, you know, because I'm sat in the grandstands and now I'm on the track. And of course, everything was rebuilt as it was when I was a spectator. And the sort of stalls inside with the corrugated, the fence post, that, as it was, you know, and I walked around looking in the cars as they had done there. You know, and so it was just overwhelming. Then they added the Spitfires and the spivs with watches and the taxi girls and just recreated, you know, my life as I grew up. And so every year we change something. You know, the driver's changing room's got a different theme and there's other things added around the track. And I remember going to Tesco. Was it Tesco? It's a supermarket. You know, the whole supermarket was done with branding as in the 60s. All the price was on it. Now I think it's a ladies' hairdressing salon, you know, as it was in the 60s, doing bouffant hairstyles. And everywhere you look, second-hand cars, aren't they, for sort of £10 and 6 shillings. And it's just, mate, it's a time warp. He's recreated. And so every year is different. And every year I've got a tear in my eye pretty much because it's just so magnificent.
Yeah, I think it's special for my generation as well. Obviously, I wasn't there back in period, but to sort of, just be taken back and experience it is extraordinary. And also the racing as well, like from your point of view,
it's fast. And the thing about, you know, luckily as being one of the Goodwood drivers, I get given a car each year. So sometimes you're at the back and sometimes you're at the front. But then you negotiate other cars with owners. Like I've got John Spears, who I've driven his lightweight E-Type now for 2 or 3 years. And so I'm very grateful to John for allowing me to drive that. But yeah, some of those, I've never been in the single seater yet. So I'm calling out for a single seater drive. I don't care if it's Formula Junior, Formula 3, Formula 2. But yeah, the magnificent cars, the racing's great. And we're all sliding around all over the place, you know, using lots of opposite lock and having to change gear and heel and toe. And so then these skills that are disappearing from a racing driver's book of skills is a shame because, you know, you can't deny it's so much easier with these flappy paddles and, you know, braking and changing down and turning into the corner with all these bits going on was much more of a challenge. And I was despair when I watched these, you know, young single-seater boys, you know, they turn into the corner, they're changing down, the apex, and then they're, and they got left foot on the brake. So the gap between brilliant drivers, this is what's happening, especially these, you know, single-mate formula, you can't actually see talent that easily. Because once the very, very good driver had looked to the telemetry of the brilliant driver, he could just copy it like a wire, you know, ring over an electric hoop. And so the very, very good driver is now within a tenth of a brilliant driver. So it's so hard. If the brilliant driver isn't quite the best car, you know, the best team or the best engineers for his Formula 4 or his Formula GB3 or whatever, you know, the very, very good driver will beat the brilliant driver because he's got a better engineer. So, a lot of the skill that was required, you know, back in late recently, as you know, my days, has disappeared. So it's become much easier to be nearly on the limit. So you watch those boys go out in Mexico, the four rookies given their rookie drive in FP1, you know. And there, Ollie Bearman did stand out to me because I'm a huge fan of him. I've never met him, no interest. But the other three were all within like 1.5 seconds of the driver in the regular driver, but Ollie was 0.2 slower than Hülkenberg. You know, I mean, just did a stunning lap time. He's 18 years. He's 18 years old. I mean, oh God. And he really does. Because I've followed, I always look at the junior single seater still, you know.
Yeah.
And if you look at someone, you look at the Formula 4, they keep on winning. Every time they go up a step, they win straight away. You can still see the talent coming through. That I despair when I see someone you're getting through that really hasn't got the results that deserve it. You know, he's just been steady, but, you know, he's done 3 years in Formula 2 and 3 years in Formula 3, you know. Because you can get to be a champion now by experience and knowing how to run, you know, a Formula 2 car or Formula 3.
Mm-hmm.
But Ollie Bearman will be, I'm sure, Britain's next Grand Prix driver.
I heard it here first.
Hopefully with a Ferrari. Hopefully replacing Carlos Sainz, perhaps, in 2025. How about that?
That would be pretty cool.
But, we shall see. There's plenty more talent still coming up through the ranks.
Unfortunately, we are coming up on time, Tiff, so I was just going to ask a few quick-fire questions, if I may.
Of course.
What is the favourite race car that you've ever driven?
It should be my Grand Prix car or my Porsche or stuff, but it's actually the March 782 BMW that I raced at Hockenheim when my second ever Formula 2 race, and I was running third, heading for the podium. I was running second, I think. I was going to beat the factory March cars, and they actually finished on the podium the first time, 1, 2, 3, when the engine broke. Another one, you see? Another one. I was there. I was going to be a star. In fact, Tom Walkinshaw was the team manager. It was a Tolman car, and I've been in touch with Tolman for a while, and they just gave me one race at the end of the year, but it was at Hockenheim, old Hockenheim, with that magnificent fast corner. And it's the last car before Grand Effect, basically. So Grand Effect ruined the world for me, because Grand Effect became a horrible understeering sort of setup. And so this 782 BMW on cross-bike tyres was just drifting through all the Hockenheim corners. And I was on top of it. I was at one. So that will remain my fastest. It's just when a car really, you know, you wear it and it works. That's the car you like.
And what is the favourite circuit you've ever driven?
Oh, that's always a different one as well. Le Mans, it's all the historic Le Mans I love. Brands Hatch Grand Prix track in England. But I'd actually probably pick Macau near Hong Kong, where I had some wonderful races but rubbish results. I should have won it one. They jumped out of gear and I kissed the wall and, oh, that was a hell of a story. Roberto Guerrero and I were racing for the lead. I've finished this quickly. It was a Formula Atlantic then, more power than the Formula 3 cars. I was racing a Japanese Toyota pad, Rolt, and Roberto Guerrero's and the Teddy Yitt Marlborough Rolts. And Roberto Moreno had fallen off at the first corner. It was about 30 seconds behind us. So it was me or him going to win the Macau Grand Prix, about two or three laps to go. He'd actually bent a fin on a wall, so I was going to get him. But for the last five or six laps on deceleration at the end of the main straight, he was jumping out of third gear, which is often happening in a gearbox if it's slightly out of worn. When you lift off, they jump out. And I was going through the Teddy Yip S's with about two laps to go, right behind Guerra's gearbox. And they hadn't done it then. And I just lifted a touch, which is all you had to do to turn into the corner. And pop, it jumped out and just made you run wide, kiss the wall, broke the wishbone. And later that same lap, about five corners later, Guerra stuck it in the wall, not realizing that I hit anything because he was under such pressure from me. So flipping Roberto Moreno's in the books as winning the Macau Grand Prix. That was 79, I think it was. And he was 30 seconds behind us. Oh. But anyway, what a magnificent circuit to race around. Yeah. Absolutely stunning. Stunning. Precision required. And that's what we lose with track limits, all these awful track limits. Because to me, the whole skin of a racing driver is speed with precision. As soon as you're allowed to go into a car park, full throttle, and come back on again, well, that's what a very, very good driver does. Whereas the brilliant driver can carry that speed within walls and inches. You know, Senna and stuff around Monaco was just absorbingly precision. Yeah. So you need those barriers near you, whether they're artificial or how you do it, to get the best driver to look the best. Macau.
That's an interesting, we haven't had that one before, so that's brilliant, yeah. And then what is, I know you said this changes by the day, but if you had to pick a dream three-car garage,
it's a stupid question. And let's be honest, stupid question. There's so many cars. But if you go for your dream cars, that sort of, I'd have a McLaren F1 and a Ferrari Dino. Ferrari Dino. I've got to have a Ferrari.
Yeah.
But I'd definitely, whatever the three, the only one I'd keep always is a Morris 1000, a convertible, with the hood down, ready to go out down the pub at the weekend. So there'll be a Morris 1000 there, convertible. But the other two would change. See, if you want a practical car, I'd have to have a... I'd have a BMW. I'd have to have a BMW. A touring, a 550 touring. Mm. Wonderful. It has to be manual. It's a wonderful gearbox for those old BMWs. So, you know, be a BMW touring 5 Series to take the family out in. But then, you know, you have Porsche Boxsters. I was like, little Porsche Boxsters. I don't know why I did, but that was a Porsche. Lamborghini Diablo. Oh, there's so many wonderful cars. It's impossible to pick.
I know.
McLaren F1.
Yeah, McLaren F1. Yeah, no, that's good. Well, yeah, unfortunately, that is all we have time for. But Tiff, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for reminding me of all these things. But I have to go back through history sometimes to remember what I actually did.
Well, you've done a hell of a lot, and it's extraordinary. Really,
well, I hope to still keep going. As long as the Duke keeps Goodwin going, I've done every revival meeting and every members meeting.
Oh, wow.
So I haven't missed a single meeting. So I've done a lot of Goodwin meetings. We did the 25th year, I think, last time, didn't we?
Yeah. That's
so I've done 25 revivals. Gosh, I must be young. Videos. I'll mention the other video that goes with what we talked about.
Sure.
Apart from the McLaren F1, if you're going to watch one Love Cars on YouTube, Love, where I still do, scroll down and find the one with the Morris 1000 Traveller, because I recreated, I borrowed a trailer because I now bought the Lotus back. The Lotus I sold in 1973, came back to Britain in 2015 or something, and someone said, I've got your Lotus. I bought it back, so it's mine again, and I repainted it in the colours as I want it. So we've done this film where I borrowed a Morris 1000, borrowed a trailer, we put the Lotus on the trailer, recreating that amazing sign of a Morris 1000 Traveller towing a racing car. Tears were in the eyes again, and it was about. I mean, I didn't have a camera back then. I couldn't afford a camera. You know, we certainly didn't have a thing called a mobile phone with a camera on it. Now these kids, so I had no photographs of it. That's why we recreated. I had not a single photograph of my Morris 1000. So now you can watch it on this YouTube thing.
I'll put the video in the written version of this interview so everyone can find it.
Put the link. Put the link in for Morris 1000. It's my favourite story I've ever made on Love Cars.
Yeah, we'll get it in there. Yeah, that's brilliant. Thank you very much, Tiff.
All the best. Cheers.